Good morning. This morning, I guess I would like to talk with you about something that was introduced to me a couple of months ago. This was new to me. It's from Dogen Shobo Genzo, and we've been talking about Dogen a lot in the past couple of months, I guess. We just got through doing practice period here at Zen Center, which is an 8-week period of intense study. And this spring we were talking about Dogen's Genjo Koan. So I kind of figured I had had enough of Dogen. And then I promptly went ahead and wrote a talk about Dogen Shobo Genzo. So what was new to me was Dogen's four basic principles for Buddhist study. And I learned about this through the work of Nishijima Roshi and his student Brad Warner. So I stole from them liberally in preparing this talk, so I want to credit them duly for all their information and their study. So I've spent a couple months just sort of thinking about these four principles, and I've decided that this makes a lot of sense to me. And I don't know if you guys have had the same experience, but every once in a while I'll learn about something, and it'll help put a lot of smaller things in my life in kind of a larger context. It sort of creates an arc where things start making sense. Instead of a bunch of individual, unrelated things, you sort of see a pattern, maybe, in those things. So I really saw a lot of patterns in what I'd learned in my Zen practice from learning these four principles. And so I'm still new to them, but I got a lot out of it, so I wanted to share that with you guys today. So, according to Dogen, the four principles for Buddhist study are establishing will to the truth is number one. Number two is deep belief in the law of cause and effect. Number three is our life is just action in the present moment. And the last one is the practice of Zazen itself. So, I'm going to expound a little bit on each one of those four, and you'll probably see how they're interrelated with one another. So the first one, establishing will to the truth, that's kind of a way of talking about bodhicitta, which is a Sanskrit word a lot of us know here who are somewhat familiar with Buddhist teachings. Bodhicitta is oftentimes translated from Sanskrit as way-seeking mind, enlightenment mind, that kind of thing. It describes the, I suppose you'd say, impulse that a lot of us feel to enter into a Buddhist path. It's, strictly speaking, it's the aspiration to attain complete enlightenment or Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. It's a very important idea in all Buddhist study, but especially in the Mahayana tradition. The aspiration to save suffering beings and the aspiration to truth as a means to that end. For ourselves, of course, but always for other beings too. So aspiration for truth. And it sounds to me also like a manifestation of right intention. For those of you who know the Eightfold Path of Buddhism, the second one is right intention. And this feels to me very much like an expression of right intention. What is it that drives me? What is it that propels my practice? The desire to help other suffering beings. So bodhicitta is first. And it makes sense that it would be first. Without some degree of bodhicitta, we certainly wouldn't be here today. We wouldn't last long in Zen practice without a very deep personal relationship with our own aspiration, what it is that drives us. Even folks who are here for the very first time today, to some degree or not, believe it or not, you have bodhicitta. It's what one of the things that propelled you here today. Unless you were, like, dragged here against your will. I'd still go so far as to say you probably have some, but that's a little different. But I actually like the way he talks about it, too. By using the word truth, that to me seems very concrete, as opposed to complete enlightenment or Buddhahood. Aspiration to truth sounds a little more Western to me. It's a little easier to approach for me. So will to the truth, he puts first. Brad Warner says, bodhicitta means you have to regard the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, as your ultimate criterion or goal. You have to be willing to accept what is true, whether or not you like it. It's way tougher than it sounds. I kind of like his informal language in that way. And I certainly agree with him that it's a lot easier on paper than it is in practice. It's very easy to say, I am a disciple of truth. And then as soon as truth brings us face to face with something about ourselves we're not too fond of, that's when it gets a little stickier. It's a little easy to talk about it in the abstract, and it's certainly very challenging to practice it. And my Zen practice has brought me up on many occasions up against truths about myself and truths about life and about the world that I found unpleasant, that I didn't want. And there have been times that I have pushed those things away, denied them, ignored them. One of my favorites is to rail against their injustice. Truth is unjust. And what that basically means is that Martin's got a very different idea of how things are supposed to go. And my ideas are always just, strangely. I don't know how that works. So does this sound familiar to any of you, that idea about, like, truth? And then when truth shows you, it's like, ooh, not quite so comfortable. But I really understand why Dogen emphasizes it. And for those of you who are more familiar with his words, I can really see where this is sort of an essence of Dogen type of thing. Truth is so such an energy for him. And this deep will to the truth, I think, has to go hand in hand with a certain degree of courage. And he doesn't mention courage by name, but I think it takes a lot of courage to really pursue truth and to be willing to sit with it, even when it's something we don't like. And I watch myself push away experiences sometimes that teach me about myself, something about me I don't want to know. I watch myself really be drawn toward, like, books, teachers, people that tell me what I want to hear, you know? And sometimes I think the best teacher is the one who tells you the thing you don't want to hear, the thing about yourself that's really uncomfortable, who's just a mirror for you, you know? And to be able to see that honestly is really... that's really setting the bar pretty high for yourself, I think. It's challenging, you know, because we really don't want to see those things. So it takes a lot of courage, I think. So will to the truth also means we've got to let go of the idea we have some place to go, something to get, or anything to gain from practice. And I didn't understand that at first, and then I kind of ended up getting it after sitting with it for a while. The idea of getting something from practice, we talk about that a lot in Soto Zen, as you guys know. The idea of sitting just to sit, practicing just to practice, not as a means to an end, not to achieve some sort of goal. It's just pure activity. As soon as we start using an activity or using a practice as a means to an end, it not only dilutes that activity, but I can see where there's something extra there. I can see where the idea of profit, transaction, accomplishment, that isn't about truth. That's about ego needs. You know? That's about ego needs. So will to truth means letting go of those things too, I think. Letting go of that idea of getting. That for me is a slow relinquishment, I think, as those things become conscious to me. My gaining ideas. Opening my hands, letting them go, relinquishing them, one idea at a time. This comes up a lot for me. The idea of getting something, I mean, it's pretty universal, I think. So it's a constant opening, constant letting go. So nothing to get from practice. No profit, no accomplishment, no fame. No one here at Zen Center thinking that, you know, you're way cool because your posture is perfect, or your chanting is right on, or your bows are just right. Letting go of all that. We can't have ideas about or expectations of any of these things, because obviously those are not truth. Those are ideas and expectations. So. Dogen says, do not practice Buddha's teaching with the intention of getting somewhere. He comes back to that a lot, for those of you who know him. So this bodhicitta can kind of sound rather lofty, as in, I want to be a Buddha so I can free all beings. which is good. But I also think that it can come from a very earthly place, a less lofty place, like our own suffering. I think our pain can cause us to seek truth. One of the things we did during the practice period that I mentioned was we talked about our own personal koans. Koans meaning a expression of reality, a sometimes puzzling manifestation of reality. And we talked in small groups with each other about whether or not we had kind of a personal koan, something we were sitting with, something that was a puzzle to us, something that was a mystery to us. What was it that fueled our practice? What was it that propelled us forward? And a lot of those stories were stories of difficulty and suffering and pain. Like, I came here because I wanted to know the truth. What is human existence? What is life and death? What is truth? Those are pretty big questions, and they have a lofty aspect to them, but they that feels more like being pushed from behind by suffering as opposed to being drawn from the front by this sort of abstract, lofty, whoa, enlightenment type of thing. So I think it can be a very grounded, this idea of will to the truth, I think can be a very grounded and very human thing. And that's certainly been my experience. That's what's driven me, I think, more than aspiration for any kind of exalted state. So. And it was certainly Dogen's experience. According to the legend of the story of his life, this koan, his personal koan, was about pain. Both of his parents had died by the time he was eight. I think it was 8 or 9. And that's what drove him. What is life? What is death? What is impermanence? What is this? I want to know. And he had a very, very powerful will to the truth. And it was fueled by this suffering. And what I like about that is that it's very personal. So it strikes me that people who have been practicing for a very long time, whether they talk about this or not, or whether they give it words or not, it seems like they've got a very deeply personal reason for practice. That's just a hypothesis of mine, but it seems like they've got a very, almost like in their body, almost like in their cells, something that brings them to that cushion every day, that brings them to Zen Center, that makes them sit retreat after retreat. It seems like you have to really be personal with that bodhicitta, with that thing that drives you, whatever it is, whatever that thing is. It seems like that's going to be very, very deeply personal. Can't be added from the outside, so. I first started practicing Zen because I thought enlightenment sounded really cool. So, probably not too lofty. That didn't last long because, as you'd probably guess, that sort of thing wouldn't. I mean, when it doesn't come after a couple weeks, you're like, wow. I've been grossly misled about what this is here. So. In fact, it's sort of funny. Every once in a while, I ask myself, like, what is it that I said? Why do I still do this kind of a thing? But at some point, it changed. It totally changed from that attraction to something outside, this idea of a lofty state, of a wonderful experience, you know, of no more suffering. It did change. It changed from being more propelled kind of from behind by that thing that doesn't have words, that puzzle. That's turned into more of a... What I'm saying is that it went from being an abstract idea to being personal. At some point, it got into me. It got into me. There's something I need to do here. And that's actually what propels me forward. Because I don't think we can do it for long if it's not personal. So I think bodhicitta is a very kind of internal type of thing. Dogen says, if you forget yourself for a while and do your practice in private, you will become familiar with the will to the truth. I really like that. If you forget yourself for a while and do your practice in private, you will become familiar with the will to the truth. That seems very personal to me. It seems like he's talking about a very personal relationship with will to the truth, with aspiration, with bodhicitta. So. Now, the one thing he doesn't mention, but I will, in my boldness, is I think for the record that this is not a one-time deal. I think it's possible to have one massive experience that's going to propel you, but that probably isn't most people's experience. I think it's a constant renewal of intention, a constant reminding yourself, what is it I'm doing again? Oh, yeah, right. I think that's why we chant those bodhisattva vows here 6 days a week. We need to be reminded. We need to keep fueling that fire. For me, that waxes and wanes, that aspiration to the truth. There are some times when I'm just really not into it today. I'm feeling vulnerable, I'm feeling sick, I feel weak, or I feel scared, and that thing is really, really big. And other days, I've got all the energy in the world, and it's all that matters to me, and it's just dun, dun, dun. So I expect that in my practice, for things to wax and wane. So that's why I say I don't necessarily think for most of us that it's a one-time deal. I don't think we always get struck by lightning and we're done. I think it's more of a constant renewal, a constant reminder. So, and the last thing I'll say about this one is our experience of the truth of our lives can be difficult if we're not ready for it. So there's probably an inherent kind of organic wisdom to why truth reveals itself to us rather slowly over time. I mean, sometimes you just get it and something's clear. Oh, I get it. But sometimes it's more of a ripening, you know? And a little bit like I was saying, like there's all these individual facts, all these individual little things I've learned, and then all of a sudden one thing comes along, it ties them all together. I think sometimes it's a slow ripening, and that seems kind of merciful to me. I usually just kind of want it, like, give me the thing. I want the truth. I'm ready. And I'm really not. So it's kind of like you don't tell a four-year-old that there's no Santa, because they're not ready. That's not cool. You know, you'll end up with some sort of weird sociopath if you tell them that. So don't tell any of the four-year-olds in your life. So yeah, it's kind of a be careful what you ask for type of thing, I think. But as our practice matures, as we do this every day, as we commit ourselves to this every day, we get much more balanced in our bodies and our minds, and we're able to take this on. We're able to take more and more. We get bigger. This container gets bigger and bigger. And we can see things as they really are. And we can see them with that feeling of ease and peacefulness and acceptance. It becomes okay. What's actually happening? The actual reality is completely okay. And we've developed enough kind of pliability and warmth and openness so that becomes okay. Whereas that same truth 10 years ago might have not been okay. So there's a patience, I think. Being patient with ourselves. So we can be diligent and steady in our commitment, but to some extent we can relax. Truth comes when it comes, no problem. And Dogen says, belief in Buddhism should be the belief that we ourselves originally exist inside the truth. The Buddhist truth exists under the foot of every human being. That's awesome. That's awesome. It just unfolds. It just comes. So that's number one. Principle number two, deep belief in the rule of cause and effect. So in Buddhism, a lot of you know the word karma. That's sometimes explained as the rule of cause and effect, the law of cause and effect. And that's pretty good. That's a pretty good definition, especially for starters. Every action has a consequence. But this principle is kind of tougher than it looks, too, just like the first one. It kind of proceeds very naturally, it seems to me, from that first one. There's always a really good reason why he puts things the way he does. And the reason I say that is because I think, to some extent, the law of cause and effect is truth. It's just truth. That's how it is. Like, oh, okay, I get it. So there's a logical extension there, kind of. And there's no escaping the law of cause and effect, despite our amazing efforts to do exactly that, almost constantly. I'll speak for myself. But despite my amazing efforts to do that constantly. Brad Warner says, most of us don't really believe in cause and effect in a very deep way. Oh, we believe in it, but we always imagine there might be some exceptions. We tend to believe that we can get something for nothing, or that the things we do to others will never come back to us. But Dogen didn't accept that kind of thinking at all. He believed that the whole universe follows the rule of cause and effect without exception. And that's certainly a Zen understanding, that there are no exceptions to that rule. And karma is a little more complicated, and I'm not going to try to unpack it because it's huge and I don't get all of it. But karma is more than just actions. It's also the intention behind the action. It's the will behind the action. It's a will to the truth. It's kind of like intention behind action. And so if I intend to harm another, even if I try that and fail, that intention still has seeds that have been planted. That is still going to come to fruit. That hurtful intention is still there, and I am going to reap the consequence of that. I am. Without fail. Without fail. Regardless of the results of the actual deed. And the same goes for our loving intentions. The same goes for our kind and compassionate intentions. So this reminded me immediately of my mom saying, it's the thought that counts. You know? So Buddhism is saying mom's right. At least my mom is right. Right? So the thought that counts. I totally get that now. So when I gave her like a really off-base gift, like the clay ashtray, and of course she's never smoked in her life, or the handful of dandelions that I picked in the backyard that she was horribly allergic to, she didn't even see those actions. The action itself was completely off-base, but she didn't even see those. All she saw was, I want to give you something. You know, she sees the loving intention there, and it's a complete success. The action, who cares? All she sees is the intention, 100% success. Karma. That's karma. That's karma. The intention behind the action is what's carried forward there. And I love that that positive karma, that intention, can carry past the mistaken action. Because I am hugely good at mistaken actions, you guys. Hugely good. But I sort of just trust, okay, if my heart's in the right place, then this is gonna, these seeds are gonna blossom. It's gonna be okay. So. Now, in Zen, things get a little more complex when it comes to karma. A lot more complex, actually, because in Zen, everything is both the cause and effect of everything else. So that's complete and total interpenetration. That's how I think of that. Complete and total interpenetration of all things. So to affect anything is to affect everything. So from this point of view, to try to escape cause and effect, to try to think that there would be an isolated event or something without any kind of consequence would be absurd. That's like completely impossible. It'd be like hitting your hand with a hammer and expecting it only to hurt your hand. Your whole body hurts. You hurt because you are connected. You to hit one thing is to hit everything. So I think the bottom line with this one is that the more deeply we accept and see that our intentions and actions affect ourselves and everyone else, the more closely we have to watch them. Buddhism comes back to this over and over again. Personal responsibility. Personal responsibility. You know, what are the intentions behind my actions? Having to ask myself that a lot. What are the intentions? You know, what can I do about this? This is my job. So we also have to know at a really fundamental level that I absolutely, positively cannot hurt anyone or anything without hurting myself. You know, when I really experience that, it becomes a little bit easier to let go of hurtful intention. Because it's me. It's really me, you know, that I feel like I want to hurt in that moment. And when I was reading this, I thought right away of Steve Hagen at Dharma Field down here. One of the things he mentions when he's teaching Kinyin, when we do walking meditation here, at Zen Center, we hold our hands in a very specific way. We always make a fist with our left hand. We put our thumb inside the fist. And he said, one way of looking at this, and one of the reasons we do this, is it's a reminder of nonviolence. I was like, I don't get it. He's like, well, have you ever tried to hit anyone with a fist when your thumb is on the inside? It hurts like crazy. It's like terrible. The other person might notice it, perhaps, but you are really not happy. He said, it's a great way of reminding us I can't hurt anyone without hurting myself. That we're not two. So that's kind of cool, actually. I'm not really sure what the connection with Kinyin is, actually, but you know, whatever. That's a really great teaching there. So, classic Buddhist teaching says, only an act that is free from greed, hate, and delusion is without karmic effect. That's an interesting way of putting it. Those are the negative. Greed, hate, and delusion, the three poisons. No karma. If you have actions that are... So they're talking about negative karma here, of course, but one of the reasons I think that we chant that bodhisattva vow, besides the aspiration to truth, besides bodhicitta, is that we have to remind ourselves of our intention, the intention behind our action. You know, free all beings. Learn the truth. go through those Dharma gates. That's a big deal. And you know what's interesting to me is that from a Buddhist standpoint, just saying that vow with sincerity has effect, has karmic effect. Just saying it, because it's your intention. And because actions come from intention, just having the intention, that produces positive karma. That's pretty cool. I kind of like that. And we may never see, and I think we often don't see the effects of our actions, negative or positive, but I think we have to trust very deeply that they're there, that all those things ripple out and they touch everybody, that they do. So, Dogen is reminding us that we really need to believe this deeply in order to understand Buddhism. So principle number three. Principle three is our life is just action at the present moment. So I like this one a lot. I like all these, but this is a good one. Just action at the present moment is a particularly good way, I think, of expressing the essence of our life, the actual experience of living. This one gets brought up again a lot for those of you who have been around here a while. I like to touch on this briefly when I'm teaching Intro to Zazen. One of the reasons we come back to the moment, one of the reasons we teach mindfulness or awareness of body, awareness of breath, anything that brings us back to the moment is because that's where our life is. You know, we do that over and over and over here. It's a huge, huge emphasis. And the comfort that I find in this is that so much of the suffering that I experience is related in some way to past and to future. So allowing myself the freedom to let go of those things releases me from some of that, at least for a while, at least for a breath, sometimes for 40 minutes, you know, letting go of those things. If nothing else, reminding myself of their illusory nature, the past, the future. I don't know those things. They're illusions. I really don't. Reminding myself of the concrete experience of now being the only thing upon which I can rely. So that's amazingly comforting sometimes. It really, really is. Brad Warner says about this one, the past is nothing but a memory, the future nothing but dreams. At best, the past and future are no more than reference material for the eternal now. The only real facts are those at the present moment. You cannot go back and correct the mistakes you have made in the past, so you better be careful right now. You can dream about your future, but no matter how precisely you construct that dream, your future will not be precisely as you envisioned it. The world where we live is existence in the present moment. So yeah, it really can't be overstated, the centrality of that idea of returning. Returning all the time to the present moment. And I suppose this is another one of those instances where we remind ourselves that often because we need to be reminded that often. How often we get lost in our stories about the past and the future. And so it's challenging, even though it's simple. And as I was sitting with this for the last few weeks, I also thought that kind of hidden in there a little bit is the principle of the idea of non-self, a little bit. I create this I, this thing that I call I, by plans for the future, memories of the past, and when I let go of all those things and there's just this moment, there's only this activity, these sensations, these sounds, these sights, it almost, at least for me, it directs my mind toward, well then hold on a minute. Am I just an entity to which these changing things are happening all the time? No, because I'm changing too. So, kind of where am I? Who is this? Who is this I? And non-self is one of those things that is really hard to talk about to folks, especially who are new to Buddhist thought, and there's a lot of resistance there, a lot of skepticism there. Even for some of us who've been doing it for a long time, non-self kind of freaks us out sometimes. I'm attached to this thing. Because the sense of self we have is so calcified, you know. It feels so real. And we also constantly reinforce it. We're constantly reinforcing this sense of self. We so believe in it, you know, that when we come up against a teaching that challenges that and points to its untruth, essentially, untruth, that's me coming right back to that will to the truth one. Like, really, how much do I want to know? Do I really want to know the truth? Even if the truth involves, ping, no self. Oof. Some days that feels great if self is suffering, but some days that doesn't feel so great if, you know, if self is having a good day. So, and it's also funny, you know, Buddhism is so weird in that it always is like simultaneously embracing opposites, you know, all the time, which is so, isn't that weird, you guys? It's always, you know, like, oh yeah, this is true, and so is its opposite. At the same time, that's great, no problem. We're so used to, you know, our whole education system here is the opposite of that, so this whole Eastern thing is really, really weird. But on one hand, no self, of course, no past, no future, all illusion. On the other hand, of course, we are real, and of course, you are exactly the sum of all of those things that created you, your family of origin, your nationality, your experiences, your biology. I mean, all those things are completely real. You are the sum of those things, you know. So, you know, having to hold those things at the same time, they sure seem to contradict each other. Having to work with them both skillfully. I like the way Brad says reference points, reference material. That past and future can be reference material for the eternal now. That's helpful. It doesn't necessarily say they're not true, but it just says they're useful only to the extent that they can inform this. So that makes sense to me. So past and future are largely about what creates and informs and supports our egoic self. And we need an egoic self. Tim talks about that a lot here, and I'm glad that he does. When I first came to Zen, my understanding was that we're supposed to destroy that completely somehow. That having any kind of sense of self or ego or whatever, just that's the enemy, and so you extinguish that somehow. I'm not sure where I got that, but I got it. But my understanding is a lot of people get that idea. What Tim talks about more is the idea of seeing that for what it is. Convenient fiction. You can have lots of cracks in ego, you know. It has its purpose. It has a use. We're not trying to destroy it. But when we do see its fictional quality, when we're able to let past and future drop, to see the truth of that, our life just becomes more simple. It becomes a little more manageable. You know, that huge problem that is overwhelming to us now that we're creating in our head, when you see it for a creation, for a fiction, it's like its spell is broken a little bit, you know. You can sort of see through it. So it's just what's happening. It's just action at the present moment. Just action. So, and of course, our experience of the present moment is in constant flux. It is constantly changing. So there's impermanence. Impermanence is hidden in there too. My favorite line is moment to moment, non-stop flow, from that Blue Cliff record case. I want to say 80, but I don't remember the number. But that's one of them. One of the teacher's answers is moment to how do you express your experience? Moment to moment, non-stop flow, just changing, constantly changing. But that isn't illusion. That flow is our life. That is our real life. This moment of non-stop flow, this thing that's changing all the time, is our experience, is our real life, and it touches everything. It touches everything in the past, everything in the future. Does that make sense? Kind of? It made sense when I wrote it. So the last one that I will talk about, mercifully, Dogen made only a list of four things. We do love lists here, don't we? The fourth principle for Buddhist study is the practice of Zazen itself. And so that's kind of a duh around here. For anybody who's used to Dogen, or if you've read even two pages of Dogen, it's just Zazen, 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 Zazen. I mean, that's his thing. That's his thing. So it's certainly no surprise that he's going to push Zazen on us like it's going out of style. That's kind of what he does. And it's also very important. And again, we need to be reminded often. So when I read about these principles and his placement of the practice of Zazen on one of the four requirements or the four principles, what I thought of is our intro to Zen meditation classes. And we reformatted that, a lot of you know, several months ago, kind of playing with that. How might we tweak this intro format to better suit our needs and better suit the community who comes to visit us. And one of the things we decided on was we're going to teach Zazen every week. We've got a series of classes, and they all vary from one another, but the one thing that never changes is Zazen. We teach it every week, we practice every week. So if you come to all those classes, you get it every week. There's a reason we do that. It's central. It's absolutely central to what we do here. This is Zen Buddhism, meditation Buddhism. That's the thing we always come back to over and over and over. In a way, I'm almost surprised he didn't put it first, just because it's such a big deal. But will to the truth and stuff makes more sense. But it's so important because it changes what's a head kind of thing, a philosophy sort of thing, an abstraction, a mental formation about Buddhist teaching and ideas about suffering and looking into things like impermanence and all that kind of stuff. It changes it into a body practice, a real thing that's your life, that you inhabit. You know, a lot of teachers talk over and over about your only real teacher, your only true teacher is Zazen. You can get words from the teacher, you get words from the books, that's all great, talks, that's all great. Who really learns it is you, and who really teaches it is you. Zazen. That's how we learn this stuff. So we repeat that over and over and over. It's just central to what we do. Brad says, Buddhism is not a philosophy you just read about. It's a philosophy you do. So the principles of Buddhism include actual action, which cannot be put into words. So in Dogen's view, the best way to learn how to truly experience the world just as it is through the daily practice of Zazen. The only way to really understand Buddhism is to do Buddhism, which means to do Zazen for yourself. That's how Dogen came to his understanding of the philosophy, because Buddhism is not about words, even Dogen's. It is absolutely impossible to understand Buddhism without the practice of Zazen. I think he's using the word Buddhism here probably as a way of indicating Zen. There are other forms that don't have the emphasis on the sitting that we do, but absolutely impossible to understand without the practice. I completely agree with that. I really, really do. And I can't even explain what it is that happens when we sit. I can't put my finger on the transformational element to it, what it is actually that happens. I have yet to figure that out, but I really believe that it's deeply transformative, and without the practice of doing it every day, it doesn't sink in. It doesn't actually change us. So Dogen says, to enter into Buddhism, always rely upon practice. So that's our first, best, and only true teacher. I am a book geek, and I have read thousands of pages about Buddhism. I love it. I think it's great. And that's been really helpful to me. But as much as I've read on practice and theory and history, and as helpful as that's been, it is daily Zazen that's changed who I am. Without question, it's the Zazen that has changed who I am. It's changed my experience of life, you know. So it used to be, at the beginning, it was something added onto my life. It was something extra. It was like, ooh, this Zen is cool. I'm going to sit every day just like they tell me to. And so it was something added. Do you know what I mean? It feels sort of like clunk, I'm adding something to my pile. Like I'm going to exercise or I'm going to whatever. Well, it was Zazen then because I want to get this enlightenment thing. So, plop, I added it to the pile of me. But, well, that's kind of how it is. But now it's not anything extra. The other stuff, some of the other stuff is falling away. And that has become the center. Zazen has become home. And that's hard to explain. So I'm not going to spend too much time trying to. But it's a little like the personal koan, the thing that you wrestle with, but you have a hard time expressing. Is that's kind of what Zazen has become for me. I don't really know what it is. I don't even know that I would say it's good or bad or pleasant or unpleasant, or it's just sort of this thing, and it's sort of not a thing. And you know, it's home, and yet it's very challenging, and it shifts all the time. And I can't really explain it, but I can't really explain it, but I know that things make sense to me now that didn't used to make sense because of that practice. And I don't mean stuff like algebra or like how to connect the printer to my computer or anything like that. Stuff like, it isn't head stuff again, it's a body thing. But it's true, things make sense to me that didn't used to make sense to me. Stuff like the spring. The spring makes more sense to me because I think I sit every day. And cat fur on my clothes makes more sense to me. Ink on paper makes more sense to me. The sound of wind makes more sense to me. Grass growing between the cracks on the sidewalk is one of my favorites. They have no hope of spreading. That makes more sense to me because I sit zazen every day. I don't know. It just does. So... So I recommend it highly, is what I'm saying. Whew, that was a risky. I'm saying something really risky here by recommending highly zazen from this seat. But I'm taking a stand. It is a gift that's been given to all of us. I think this teaching is such an amazing gift. I have such gratitude for it, and there's that part of me, I just watch this part of me really get like activated when I'm upstairs teaching intro class. There's just that little part of me that wants to like talk to all of them one-to-one for just like 30 seconds and do that kind of like Vulcan mind meld that they did on TV and just go like, seriously, just believe me, this will change your life. Just please do it. I know it's hard and I know it's boring and I know you're backwards, but please, I swear to God, it's going to change your life. But I don't often say that, thank goodness, or they'd probably run fleeing some. So I offer you this today. These four principles I think are really helpful. They were really neat for me to live with for the past several weeks. And again, they were new to me. This hadn't been framed quite this way. But it was helpful, and I think it's really, really good stuff. And I offer it because I think it's support. You know, support and encouragement is the one thing that I think we always try to get back to. When we're at this place, to encourage each other to stick with it, encourage each other to practice, to support each other in this practice. Whether we've been doing this for 30 years or whether this is our first day, we really, really need that. And when I looked at these four things, I thought, these are things we have already, to some degree. Even if you set 5 minutes of zazen in your life, you already know. Bodhicitta, will to the truth, these are things that are universal. To some extent, we all have them. There's not an exclusive sort of Buddhist club that you've got to have these four things and then you're in, you know. They're universal. They're universal human things. But he's outlined them in this way to be of help to us, to be of support to us. So when we give ourselves more and more to Zen practice, when we give ourselves more and more completely to Buddhist study, one of the things we see is how much of that we already had. That's cool. I love that about it, that it's something I already had, something we all already have. And as we study it, we see that it was something we always had. That's why I trust truth, I think. Because I think all of us know that experience of hearing something, learning something that's true, and you know it in your bones. Do you know what I mean? There's nothing with cultural conditioning or family of origin or anything. You know it, you recognize it. Because something happens, your chest opens, or you recognize, true. Even if you don't like it, you know, death, life, spring, grass. It's true. It's real. We all recognize that. So I don't think he's talking about anything that are qualities that are unique to Buddhism or something that has to be added to your life. These are something we all possess. It's this universal stuff. And we all recognize that when we experience it. And it's not something we have to go outside of ourselves to find. It's something that's inside of all of us, I think. And it's not something that's added on to our lives because we're lacking it, because we don't lack it. We already have it. It's here already. And we don't have to look far for it, because it's closer than our breath. It's closer than our thoughts. In fact, we really don't have to look for it at all, because we are it. We are it. So that's it for me. Thank you. Any comments, questions, complaints? Anything that starts with a C?
When you said one comment about moment-to-moment flow, I think a lot of times my experience of life is moment-to-moment Velcro.
That is a little more accurate, isn't it?
Yeah, well, just for me, probably.
Yeah, no, I think that's... I think it's not just you, probably.
Yeah.
The constant ripping sound is me wanting to hang on to my current experience. Matt.
Yeah, thanks for the talk, Mike.
You are welcome.
I just wanted to ask, where did you read that from, Brad Warner?
I only have the first book of Shobogenzo. So I could not find it in the first book of Shobogenzo. I am guessing it must come later. I actually don't know. Nishijima Roshi is Brad's teacher, so he's kind of just absorbed most of that. And Nishijima is like a massive Dogen guy. And that's pretty much, he's a Zazen only and just Dogen guy. Really, that's pretty much all he does. And so I know Brad got that from Shobogenzo. He didn't refer to where. I got that from somewhere in the first few chapters of Sit Down and Shut Up. And then, again, I've got the Nishijima translation of Shobogenzo, but I only have the first. There's like four. For those of you who don't know, Shobogenzo is a huge book. It's hundreds of pages long. It's kind of his life's, I don't know what you'd call it. It's Dogen's masterwork, his magnum opus. And I couldn't find it in the first part, but I just wanted to play with those ideas because I liked him so much. But yeah, I had the same question, like, geez, where did he find this? Does anybody know that by any chance? Any of you guys who are more Dogenophiles than I am? Is that a word? Sure it is. Sure it is. Anyway, so I don't know. Yeah, you bet. Yes, Dean.
I just wanted to say thanks for your inspiration. It's been months since I've been here, and I just, again, already feel like, oh yeah, that's right. It's so helpful when I sit regularly. You know, I do feel like I meditate a lot during the day and stay with my breath, but I'm usually still grasping and trying to do something, thinking I'm going to get somewhere and arrive, and it'll be better, you know, do a bit if I can, you know, get all these things together. And it's like that sitting, you know, seeking the truth, you know, that part of that mind, the way-seeking mind. And it's like if we are this, you know, the universe unfolding, and you were saying that there's nothing we have to do, it's constantly arising. So, you know, sometimes I get a little concerned for, you know, people that are new or to this practice, but it's like, so if everything is constantly arising within us, the universe, if you will, or the experience of being human, and if just sitting and watching it is an expression of that, and then I often think, well, I want to sit because I want to reduce my suffering. Sometimes sitting feels painful. Either physically or sitting with my emotional discomfort feels like it's more suffering. It's actually, I'm just surrendering to what's already happening anyway. So sitting, sure, I'm not going to get something, but there are great benefits.
Isn't it weird now?
That happens from sitting, right?
Yeah. So, you're totally right. It's another one of those great paradoxes of you sit without purpose, but of course you get something. But you don't sit to get the thing, you sit just to sit. And the more you sit without goal, the more you get the thing. I totally get it. It makes perfect sense to me. Yeah, and sometimes like being more intimate with suffering is what helps us see through it and let it go. So I completely get it, you know. That's why I never can really land with Zazen. I just can't... You know what I mean? I'm always trying to solidify what it is, what it does. And I just knew the... My brain just refuses to do it. We've got this binary machine, you know, ones and zeros up here, and this is a three. And it doesn't know what threes are. It just doesn't. And then smoke starts coming out. And so I don't get it, but I totally get what you're pointing to. Yeah, and incredibly fuzzy logic, to the point where maybe just fuzz. Maybe no logic. Anybody else have anything today? All right. Well, thank you. Oh, did you have?
Just one follow-up to what you're saying. I answered it twice about, you know, what is it about sitting that, you know, transforms anything you said at one point. And I've been reading some real interesting stuff, and when they look at some of the Western psychological view of what happens, why is, they say some of the most transformational practices are sitting meditation and doing psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the act of, I always think on this subject, this narrow, smaller, contracted suffering, I don't like my situation or whatever, and I sit down and I follow my breath and I watch myself, my thoughts. So they say it's like, here's the subject, and then when we practice sitting, we now, this thing I'm identified with, the subject, I'm now making it an object. So then now I'm this new subject, which is this, what I thought I was, this object, plus this newer expanded awareness. So it's like, the best way I've heard it described, why it's transformative, is the subject of one level becomes the object of the subject of the next. And it's constantly this...
creating another observer.
Right.
Yeah.
Making the ego bigger. So it can hold everything as opposed to trying to get rid of the ego. Because only the ego wants to get rid of the ego.
Yeah, makes sense. Somebody once told me that Katagiri said the hardest thing is to let go of the observer. I don't know what that's from. I don't know in what context he said that, and I still don't even know if I get it. But that was interesting to me, because I always think of, as soon as we introduce the idea that there's an observer and that we watch our thoughts, that's a huge step. Like, we disidentify for the first time for a lot of us with our thoughts, and you realize, oh my God, I'm not my thoughts. I can't stop them. I can't start them. I can only control them to a very, very small extent. And all of a sudden, oh, then I must be this. Oh, no. Then it's something else and something else. And I think he's eventually talking about letting go of that even, too. So, yeah. Yeah, the mystery continues. All right, cool. Thank you all very much.